Blog Talk Radio.
And good afternoon from Fairfax, Virginia, where it's a balmy late summer day. And today we are going to go and talk on Military Monday about the only subject on television and in the media, Syria. Now, I'm sure that you've probably had all the Syria you need to go and fill your day, your week, your month, and your year. But despite the amount of coverage, quantity does not always equal quality, nor does it equal clarity. And so today we're going to do a show on Syria with one difference. We're not going to talk about who did it. We're not going to talk about what happened. I think that that's fairly obvious. Somebody popped some poison gas over a suburb of eastern Damascus, and a lot of people died. We're not going to assign blame. We're not going to talk policy. We're not even going to talk about the authorization and the debate. We're going to talk about, okay, what happens if at the end of the day the president decides it's time to strike and we decide to go ahead and turn loose the U.S. military on Syria. And to talk to us today, we have a guest that's been kind enough to be with us before, a friend of mine going back more years than I care to mention now, almost 30 years, one of my best friends in the media and otherwise, a best-selling novelist, author, and a game designer whose harpoon game is used by both hobbyists, the media, and even the government to go ahead and figure out what they're doing at times. I'm speaking of Mr. Larry Bond. And Larry, are you with us?
Yes, I am still here, John, in spite of 30 years of whatever. Don't start talking about how long we've known each other. I have to pull out a calculator. It's daunting.
Yes, I know. And we both remember who was president back when we met, so we'll leave it at that. Anyway.
Was it Grant? No, I'm sorry.
One of the Roosevelts, I think. We obviously have in front of us a daunting problem. We have Syria, a country, sort of, sideways. It is a country in the midst of a civil war, at least as ugly or more so than our own 150 years ago. And we have a policy initiative out of the White House to go and use military force to go and suppress their continued usage of chemical weapons. Now, that said, let's talk about Syria, the country, and the target. What kind of things are there if we decide to go and strike at Syria? What are you going to hit? Are you going to aim them all at where you think President Assad is, or what is it you want to actually diminish or degrade with this airstrike or airstrikes?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't strike at Assad directly. I mean, business before pleasure. I think the if we have to attack, the first round of targets is I think fairly obvious. It's going to be his air defense units. Not only the SAMs and launchers themselves, but their IAS control centers, anything that looks like a command and control. We basically have to shut their air defense down, which is not terribly difficult. There's a lot of information out there on the Syrian air defenses, and it's mostly 70s and 80s equipment that's not well netted together and is not operated by top-notch personnel. They haven't had a lot of practice, and the last time it was tested was in 2007 when the Israelis flew into Syrian airspace to bomb a secret nuclear reactor that the Syrians were building, and the Syrians didn't even know the Israelis were there until they heard the boom.
True enough, but by the same token, we don't take Syria for granted, as in 1983 when we got our nose bloodied in an attempted strike into the Bekaa Valley. And, of course, the Turks last year who lost an F-4 tooling up the coast. These are not...
Well, if,
not hairballs. They do what they do have. They use and use fairly well. Correct?
They're competent on an individual basis. As an organization, I think that there are some serious issues. If their static launchers are vulnerable, obviously the SA-5s, the S-200s, the Russians call them, are static with fixed radars. Those are Tomahawk bait. The mobile launchers are more of a problem, but they have to radiate radars to be effective. And you're talking HARMS, you're talking guided missiles now with Datalink, Tomahawk. We can update these guys in flight. I don't think their SAMs are simply de rigueur for hitting anything else. Once the SAMs are out of the way, then you've got to worry about the Syrian Air Force. Such as it is, some of the bases have been captured by the rebels. They have some MiG-29s. They have some Su-24s. The Su-24s are a potential strike threat into the Mediterranean, although the chances of them ever surviving past our naval air defenses are pretty slim. But we might hit those just on general principle, just to remove even the possibility of a threat. I think the fact that Assad flew a couple Su-24s over towards Syria, what was it, yesterday or the day before?
Towards Cyprus, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Cyprus. I think that was half him, you know, thumping his chest. The other half was seeing whether or not they could actually get there or not. You have to treat the threat seriously, and the Syrian Air Force would be number two on the hit parade. After that, you start talking about your strategic war aims. I don't believe we're going to attempt to destroy the chemical weapons themselves. That would be a huge mistake unless we have weapons that I'm not familiar with. I mean, John, you know as much about thermobaric warheads as I do. They need an enclosed space to work properly, correct?
Correct, and let's face it, some of the chemical mixtures don't break down rapidly even in a thermobaric warhead environment.
Yeah, so the idea of, well, we'll just blow up the chemical weapons and that solves the problem, that doesn't help. You have to go over after the delivery systems. Now, the Air Force happens to be one of those delivery systems, so you've taken that away. The next level down is chemical rockets and artillery shells. Those, striking those would be good. They're a diffuse target. There's going to be a lot of them all over the place. On the other hand, they will tend to be concentrated as batteries or near command elements, so they can be located and found. But it's not a simple process. They are extremely mobile. I think you'd agree with that.
Oh, no question. Not to mention, of course, even though they probably only have a limited number that can carry chemical weapons, they do have cruise and surface-to-surface ballistic missiles as well, which they can use to raise a certain level of havoc.
I'm always in favor of nailing Scuds, just on general principle. They're almost too big to use against a defenseless Damascus neighborhood. The Scuds, if they can be found, would actually serve two purposes. One, they'd remove the threat to the Syrian population. They also remove the threat to the Israeli population, because one of the options for a counterattack has been Assad going after or firing Scud missiles into Tel Aviv or Israel, just because he can and just to show how mad he is at us. Because everyone knows that Israel is the U.S.'s cat's paw in the Middle East, right?
Well, I've heard it. I've heard it abused verbally with several nicknames, including America's Chihuahua. I just don't think I'd want to put my hand out and say nice doggy at this point.
The Israelis are vulnerable to Scud attacks from Syria, and if Assad chose to use Scuds against Israel, that's precisely the kind of thing we want to avoid, widening the war, because Israel would come back at Assad in ways I don't want to imagine. our target list would include any chemical weapons delivery system that we had a definite location on. I don't think we're just going to go raining general death because we don't want to inflict any more civilian casualties than we have to. But destroying the delivery systems is the first level. The next level after that down is going after command and control and intelligence facilities that either plan or make decisions about launching chemical attacks. And that's kind of a gimme to me because those are the guys that actually said, yeah, let's do it, and those are the guys that made it happen. So definitely remove those from the chain.
Do you see us striking at general purpose forces like company, battalion, brigade, regimental headquarters to try and, you know, take the head off of his military in any way?
That's a very interesting question, and it gets down to just how many of his military units are qualified to use chemical weapons. I mean, is everyone in his military equally qualified, or does he have certain special units? For instance, there's one unit that's commanded by his brother, and it's probably extremely trustworthy. I might make it my business to attack that unit's headquarters and subordinate headquarters because those guys may have been involved in the actual attack. In general, no. I mean, there's simply too many of them. The Syrian army is a large thing. If we're trying to keep this limited to, let's say, less than a week, we can't start attacking general-purpose forces.
Good enough. So we're going to look for forces that are somehow involved in delivering his weapons of mass destruction, things that could harm Israel, and things which could go ahead and defend them against further strikes if required, correct?
Correct. I'd add one more element to the list, which would be things that he might be thinking about doing to us. He's threatened retaliation, and, you know, certainly if I would expect him to respond in some way, we would look at the Bastion coastal defense missile batteries that he got some time back. Now, the Israelis have already torn a chunk out of those, but they didn't get them all. And I assume the others are in hiding, you know, hunkered down, waiting for their chance to strike. If we're dumb enough to sail within observation range of the coast, he could wheel those out, and then we'd have to deal with them quickly, or they could do some serious harm.
We'll talk more about Assad's response options here in a couple minutes. Let's now talk about, okay, Americans love their toys and their gadgets. What kind of weapons are we planning, in your opinion, to use in this? I don't know that you'd call it an air campaign, but you wouldn't just call it an airstrike, this mini campaign that seems to be on the horizon. What would be the primary weapons in your mind?
Well, everybody knows about Tomahawks now. They used to be the photon torpedo. These days they're sort of, we can throw Tomahawks out there too, and people know how to bring them down. One of the reasons we might try and take out the Syrian Air Force early on is because, you know, if they get their planes up, they could actually try and intercept and shoot down Tomahawk missiles in flight. They don't go particularly fast.
And their chances, some of which have capabilities against Tomahawk and other cruise missiles.
Yes. But beyond Tomahawk, you're talking precision-guided munitions carried by not only the carrier strike aircraft off of Nimitz, but by the B-2s, B-1s, that could come from bases in the continental U.S., unless they've been staged in places like Cyprus or closer. These days, it's almost, you know, anything static will use some flavor of JDAM, either with a unitary or a cluster warhead. Although I'm not sure, I have to correct that, I'm not sure what the status of our cluster munitions is vis-a-vis international treaty anymore, whether we still
We're only allowed to use brilliant munitions, the ones that leave a quote-unquote clean battlefield.
So you got your smartphone and your smart bomb. The small diameter bombs are going to be sufficient for most targets, and those are deliberately intended to reduce collateral damage. At the same time, you can carry a whole bunch. I think a Strike Eagle can carry 32 of them, and they can each be aimed at an independent static target. So let's say you have a static array of SAMs. One F-15 could theoretically clean out an entire battery. It's pretty amazing, especially the GPS guided munitions can be launched in what's called a loft toss delivery, where basically you come in at medium or high altitude at high speed. At the appropriate moment, which is somewhere between 15 miles to the target, you pull up sharply. Your computer tracks your ascent and at the appropriate moment releases the ordnance automatically, and it describes a arc. It actually climbs up even higher, and that gives the GPS guidance time to find satellites and lock on and figure out exactly where it is and where it knows where the target's pre-programmed target is, and then it goes over. Meanwhile, your aircraft, which is pulled up sharply, is pulled over even farther, so it's now inverted and heading in the general direction of away from the target. He rolls flat, and he's now headed home for Miller time. Never gets close to short-range defenses. Long-range missiles are another issue, but if we've done our job, they're already gone.
You're talking about the big S-200/SA-5s, which have like a 300-kilometer range if you can see out that far.
I have a hunch that if those radars are radiating, they're going to collect a harm real fast. I also think that, it's a Cold War system, which it's fine. We built stuff in the Cold War, too. What I should say is it's an old system. If you're in a B-52 at high altitude, an SA-5 is death on toast. If you're in a smaller fighter, you first of all can't be detected or engaged as far, and the SA-5 can only shoot one missile at a time, which compared to some of the multiple engagement systems both sides are fielding now, seems almost pathetic. If you can knock out the single radar provides guidance for the entire battery, you've effectively knocked them out of the war.
And to our listeners, if you have questions or comments, please feel free to call in. Our call-in number is area code 347-945-7246. If you have questions for myself or Mr. Bond, again, that's area code 347-945-7246. Larry, it's been a while since we've gone feet dry against any sort of real air defense capability. That probably dates back over a dozen years to Operation Allied Force against Serbia back in the late 1990s. Obviously, time and technology have not stood still. What kinds of new things would the Syrians be facing in the U.S. arsenal? I'm going to start with a new family of cruise missiles called JASSM. Go ahead and talk about that, if you will.
Well, JASSM, they're going to come off of aircraft, either the bombers or the tactical strike aircraft. And this is, I don't see anything that the Syrians can do to stop these. First of all, they're stealthy. So the Syrian air defenses won't see them until they're almost there. And they not only can be programmed for a static target, they can be updated in flight. And, oh, by the way, the JASSMs will tell us how they're doing. It's a very capable weapon, and I'm trying to remember what the loadout is on a B-1. It's a little frightening if you think about the amount of
If you don't carry a fuel tank in the aft bomb bay, 24.
Yeah, that's 24 separate targets, which the B-1 can launch almost faster than we can talk about. Really, anything that's standing still in the Syrian target array is a valid target for JASSM. It's got a large unitary warhead. I don't think they've adapted cluster warheads for the JASSM yet.
Not yet, but it does have a smart fuse and can do very adaptive things to a wide range of targets.
Yeah, to the extent that the Syrians are targets are hardened either by bunkers or other means, JASSM won't slow them down. And we're not even talking about the range of larger U.S. munitions, the MOAB and the is the MOAB the biggest one now, John? I've lost track.
Okay, that's the MOAB is the high explosive one. Versus MOAP, which is the big penetrator, which those are the size of the old World War II Grand Slam bombs.
Yeah, and they're GPS guided, which means you can launch them from a distance. Although, frankly, seeing a B-1 execute a lob toss maneuver with a MOAB, you know, I so hope somebody gets a video of that if it happens, because that would be something to see. A B-1 could do it.
A B-1 has almost fighter thrust to weight and is strikingly maneuverable. Having gone and spent some time around that community, I never fail to be impressed with what they can do, especially when they get down low and crack the burners. They're like a scalded cat down low.
Absolutely. So MOAB could be used to make a psychological point with the Syrian air defenses, like cratering their entire air defense headquarters. But, you know, again, let's get back to business before pleasure.
Now, there's another advanced system that we don't talk about much, but it's more of a capability than an actual system, and that's something called electronic attack, a benign term for going and using electromagnetic radiation off of certain types of radars and other systems to go and fry Syrian electronics. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, that's something that's, again, more a theoretical capability, and in different, you know, conflicts and incidents over the past decades, you know, the U.S. has taken opportunities like this to test or actually use those capabilities. For instance, I can remember the carbon fiber weapons that we used in Iraqi Freedom, or was it Desert Storm to scramble?
Desert Storm, yeah.
Yeah, Desert Storm. Electronic attack. Basically, you're taking part of the radar. What radars normally send out electronic pulses to detect targets. You're listening for the echoes. Everybody understands basically how radar works. Well, instead of simply sending out a pulse and looking for an echo, if you match frequencies with a known emitter and ramp up the gain, you can literally fry the other guy's electronics. This was actually done as early as Vietnam, when an SPS-40 was used to was tuned to the exact frequency of several North Vietnamese coastal radar stations, and it just knocked them off the air one after the other. So it's not a new thing, but the capabilities of the computers these days that control radars and the flexibility of a phased array antenna are such that you can point a beam focus it very tightly and pump an immense amount of power into it and make the other guy's radar go away.
And the systems that can do this are found on advanced fighter aircraft like the F-22, the F-18, E and F, Super Hornets, things of that sort, correct?
Theoretically. I mean, you know, I think for obvious reasons, the capability to actually do it hasn't been announced. It's been discussed in the technical press for years, but no exercise no public exercise of the capability has ever been announced. So if we see Syrian radars starting to go bad just of their own accord, that might be the first indication that we actually have that capability and are using it in this conflict.
again, you know, who knows what we will see. Are there any other things that you can think of that might be used that are new or different or unique from previous air campaigns?
What I think, you know, again, going back to the electronic theme, is if we decide to use a Suter tactic on the Syrian air defense net, Suter is actually part of a code word for a U.S. Air Force program called Senior Suter, which is part of a larger program, which I think is Big Safari, which is designed to attack enemy command and control networks electronically. And this is not your father's jamming. This is not, you know, firing white noise at his radar so he can't see anything. This is hacking his computer network. This is it's a Jedi mind trick where you go in and basically say these are not the planes you're looking for. It involves electronic techniques which I won't even try to explain, where basically you invade his computer network. And the more tightly knitted he is, the better chance it is that it will work. And even if it doesn't work well, at a minimum, you get to see the entire status of his air defense network. If it works, you're going to be able to shut down his missile systems, redirect his fighters in the wrong direction. There are strong indications that the Israelis used something like a Suter attack in 2007. Which is why the Syrians had no idea that they were coming. If it's done perfectly, the other side doesn't even know they're being hacked until it's too late. If we use Suter tactics, that could be a real game changer in terms of our ability to destroy or disable the Syrian air defenses and reduce the risk of us suffering any casualties.
And that takes us to the next thing we're interested in asking about, which is, okay, you're Syria, and the United States has gone and smote you. What do you do about it? What are your response options? And what kind of weapons, let's go back over the weapons they have, which we might want to be careful about getting involved with.
Well, we've already mentioned the Yakhont or Bastion cruise missiles that they have. The actual conditions of the batteries are problematical at this point since we don't know what damage the Israelis inflicted on them. But we can assume that if they have two batteries, I don't think the Israelis were lucky enough to nail them both. So there's going to be at least one out there that we have to worry about. The SAMs can, you know, any given lucky golden BB can take down an aircraft. So the SAM threat is real and has to be respected. As far as the Air Force, they've still got MiG-21s and MiG-23s in their inventory, and the question of their maintenance is problematical. If we as a given will have E-3 and J-STARS support that can basically cover the entire region, we can assume that anybody that takes off and we don't like will be intercepted and shot down. And I'm sorry, I'm going to be a little biased and say that there are a lot of things going against the Syrians if an air battle results. Am I being humble enough there, John?
Well, I think it's a fair statement to say there's going to be a race between the guys on the Burke-class destroyers trying to line up a shot with Aegis versus whoever's got the combat air patrol duty trying to get an AMRAAM on target.
I think there's a definite risk of blue on blue, you know, and basically that's them tripping over each other trying to get it. And any Iraqi aircraft, I'm sorry, Iraqi, old habits die hard, Syrian aircraft that flies. Their artillery, their other ground-based systems have no ability to strike at our naval forces. Their Su-24s, I really don't know what the status of the Su-24s is, so I shouldn't make any assumption. John, what have you heard about their condition and their capabilities?
We know two of them can fly.
That's true, but
other
than
that,
Russian Su-24.
They're not putting out press releases on availability and reliability.
Yeah. I mean, a Russian Su-24 Fencer flown by Russian pilots with Russian gear would be a formidable opponent because they'd be carrying PGMs, their crews would be properly trained. But there's no information on how many flying hours the Syrian pilots have on average, what ordnance they've been trained with, or even if they have PGMs in their inventory. It's possible that if Su-24 is attacked, it would be with dumb bombs, which would be very bad for the Syrians, I would think. The biggest threat, the most credible threat from Assad is going to be what he does in terms of terrorism, sponsored either through Hezbollah or his own special forces or through Iran. They can't. His conventional forces basically are no match for the U.S. and anybody who's allied with us. So he's going to have to command us asymmetrically. There's no question of that.
And you mentioned earlier, and as we know, Saddam Hussein set the standard for crazy back in 91 when, in response to the attacks by the coalition, he went and attacked Israel as an attempt to divert attention and help break up the coalition. Do you see Assad being that crazy, and would he think seriously about attacking Israel? Or do the Israelis have an attitude and systems in response that would make that a mute response?
I mean, this is the Middle East. You got to go with the crazy. I wish I could say that we're dealing with a rational actor, but if we were dealing with a rational actor, I think he would have already packed his bags and moved to Miami. Assad is looking to create as much hate and discontent as possible to try and stay in power, and he may believe that striking at Israel, well, first of all, it would be good for domestic consumption and for the radical Islamists who think, well, I woke up and had breakfast this morning, I think I'll strike Israel. So it's just something it's a reflexive thing. In Desert Storm, we had to work very hard to keep Israel from striking back at Iraq. I don't know if we're going to be trying that hard if Israel wants to strike at Syria. I mean, Israel and Syria have a long history of hitting each other. And, you know, if his father was still around, I think we could talk about the Israeli incursion into the Kaa Valley and what happened to the Syrian Air Force back then. What was the score? 23-0?
Oh, you're talking about the Bekaa Valley Turkey shoot back in the '80s?
Yeah.
103-1.
103? I had heard it was that. I heard. Okay, well, I'm just must be remembering the numbers wrong. It was absurdly one-sided.
Yeah, and the one that they lost was lost, I believe, to a SAM.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was an F-4, a very old, cranky F-4. But yeah, there was, in addition to the strike that they made against the SAM batteries in the Bekaa Valley, taking them out in a couple of hours, there then was a three-day air battle where more than 100 MiGs and other aircraft from the Syrians went and got shot down by the Israelis, who were flying state-of-the-art, brand-new F-15s and F-16s armed with some of the best air-to-air missiles in the world at the time. It was not...
Yeah, and they're still just as good.
Well, it's worth saying that when asked to go and describe it, someone said it was one Israeli pilot I know who was there and got himself a couple of MiGs said it was easier than going out and clubbing baby seals.
The basic dynamic. Politically
incorrect verbiage, but I think everybody gets the idea.
Yeah, the basic dynamic of the military situation is that Sadat's military, which was not all that strong to begin with, has been crippled by a civil war. I mean, a lot of guys have defected, and I almost said a bad thing there. You can't say on radio. And they've defected, and then the rebels have captured other or destroyed other assets. So his military is damaged, and now he's facing a collective group of countries with first-line armament. And if he wants to add one more, yeah, he can go attack Israel. That doesn't sound like a rational choice, but yet he may choose that.
Again, he's into regime survival mode right now. He just wants to keep his palace and his gold and rule his country until he dies and he can hand it over to his kid.
Well, as long as the Russians and the Iranians back him wholeheartedly as they're doing now, he's got no reason to think he can't survive. He's got a fighting chance.
Now, let's go and talk about reality on the ground, in the air, and on the seas. What kind of lineup of U.S. forces do we have out in the Eastern Mediterranean right now to go ahead and prosecute this?
Well, they keep on coming out with these new graphics, and the Mediterranean is getting more and more and more crowded. I would like to be in an E3, assuming I can still read the symbology if they haven't changed it, and just see exactly how many ships are crowded where and into the Eastern Med. You've got two different groups of U.S. ships, a carrier battle group in the Red Sea. As far as I know, the carrier battle group with Nimitz is still in the Red Sea. It has not moved into the Western Med. Do you have any information on the Nimitz battle group's movements?
Not yet, but they could transit it in a day if they needed to.
Yeah.
And the same thing with the Kearsarge Amphibious Ready Group. Both of them are in the Red Sea. Both of them are mobile enough that they could go ahead and take up position off Syria within 24 to 36 hours. Egypt alone.
There's also a fairly heavy-duty, surface action group is usually two or three ships. There are five that we know about. Four destroyers that we know about around San Antonio. They're loaded with Tomahawk.
Yeah, let's make sure San Antonio is an amphibious dock ship there to go ahead and conduct non-combatant evacuation and combat search and rescue if required.
Yes.
And there is another one that's down toward Israel providing ballistic missile defense support to the Israelis just in case, again, our friend Assad gets frisky.
Yeah. So I'm trying to remember what we normally keep in the Med. And I don't know if we even keep a carrier battle group in the Med consistently.
Not anymore. It's rare, but if we do, it sends a big message. And of course, we got submarines, probably a couple of them.
I would venture a guess there's at least two. Equipped with Tomahawk, of course, as most of them are these days. Whether they're limiting themselves to simply, sitting in a basket waiting for the go code or not, it's possible that the submarines could also be conducting SIGINT missions along the Syrian coast, maybe even special warfare operations when it's dark over there. I don't know. That's really wild stuff to consider, but it could be happening.
Yeah, because one of those subs could easily be one of the converted boomers, the Ohio-class boats that were converted over to Tomahawk and SEAL carriers.
Yeah, the only question is, how many SEALs or how many Tomahawks did they load on that thing before they sent it out? I don't know again, I'm trying to remember the exact number of Tomahawks that an Ohio boomer SSGN can launch, and it could easily double the number of missiles available to the U.S. It's a frighteningly high number.
If you actually fill all of the launch cells on one of the converted boomers, I think the number is 154.
That sounds about right. And of course, SEALs are another.
Yeah, and of course you can on a Virginia or a Los Angeles, you can probably put another 24 realistically.
Yeah, 24 is on the improved LA boats. It's actually 12, but then you could put some in the torpedo tubes as well. You have part of your armament. It depends on how much we wanted to prep these boats before we sent them underway, because it's taken them more than a few days to get here, get to the Western Med and take a position. So there may be some less than optimal loads based on who was close by and what was going on. There's a lot of U.S. firepower.
Yeah, but you just put up a point, and that is, who else is in the neighborhood? Talk about the neighbors that our ships in the Eastern Med have these days.
Well, there are British units on Cyprus, of course. The Turks are right there, and I'm sure they're watching everything with deep interest. The Israeli Navy is operating off the coast, although you have to wonder how close are they staying. Are they ranging out to provide more information, or are they staying close to avoid getting shot in some sort of a horrible mistake? The big players are the Russians, of course. There are five Russian ships that we know about, all fairly modern. Noise Tsunoshimi is the newest of the ones that are out there, but there's an Admiral Pantelia, I can never pronounce that word, Panteliev, and Nevelsky, Shablin. There's also a huge AGI Peresovet, and she's just sucking up every electron that's out there. If we go, I mean, one of the downsides of going in against Syria or some other country and conducting an offensive operation is the Russians are going to be there and watch every move we make, and they're going to learn from it what our capabilities are. You know, so when we talk about electronic attack, it might not be used because the Russians might learn too much about what our capabilities are.
And of course, we have French ships out there. We might have Greeks, and then there's a huge amount of merchant traffic that transits the Eastern Med, coming out of the Bosphorus and out of the Suez Canal. I mean, as maritime areas go, this is what Mahan used to call a choke point, right?
Choke point doesn't even cover it. You know, you pointed that out to me earlier, and I was not aware of just how much merchant traffic went through that part of the ocean. Deconflicting and positively identifying the location of hostile versus civilian units, or, you know, red versus white, is going to be a big part of this. And it may have a lot of different implications. For instance, terrorist attacks by small boats against Allied ships or even against ships which are merchant but happen to be flying the same flag as we fly. That could be a Syrian response. So while we're tracking those guys, we also have to keep very close tabs on any that represent potential targets for Syrian or Hezbollah operations.
Which takes us into the question of asymmetrical responses. Obviously, if Assad gets really desperate and crazy, he might see fit to maybe turn loose some of those coastal defense cruise missiles and just fire them into the merchant sea lanes and see what they run into. That would certainly upset the world and would make Lloyd's very, very unhappy.
Well, it's part of that whole spreading the pain philosophy. And I think the only, you know, again, that doesn't sound like a logical response to you and me, because he's just pissed off even more people. And if we're trying to build a coalition, the last thing he should be trying to do is, you know, that kind of negative influence, which is just says, oh, yeah, we need to go stop this guy. But from his point of view, he's saying, you think that's bad, I can do even more if you threaten me. Or if you continue to attack me, I will do more things to other people. And it's like, you know, the kid who gets punished for setting a trash can on fire and says, oh, well, wait until I set your house on fire. He's got nothing to lose. As long as his little corner of Syria is safely occupied by his particular Alawite allies, he doesn't care about the rest of Syria or the rest of the world.
There is a certain resemblance to Cleavon Little coming into the town in Blazing Saddles in this situation.
I generally try and avoid drawing analogies between Mel Brooks movies and international situations. It's generally not a good fit. But this case, I'm uncomfortable, but yeah.
yeah, common sense. It's not very common in this situation.
Well, we are talking about the Middle East. I mean, we have to get inside Assad's head when we talk about targeting. We went through a list of what are very, very sensible military targets: SAMs, Air Force, artillery systems. Is this what Saddam really cares about? I mean, if we bomb the bejeebers out of him and then go away, are his Russian buddies just going to bring in more advanced SAM systems for him? If we bomb his artillery and take it away, is Iran simply going to provide him with more artillery? We have to really look at the kind of damage we're doing to him and the kind of I don't like to talk about sending messages. If you want a message, use Western Union. But we've got to inflict enough pain on him so that he decides that he doesn't want to do that anymore. If we're going to do this, it has to be not limited or appropriate, but painful. And that's, we have to figure out what Assad really hates to lose and then go after that.
And here's a question that I think represents a really important one when you're targeting Assad. He's always, prior to this civil war, he looks like a rational actor. He's got a pretty wife. He used to go and have dinner with John Kerry and Hillary Clinton, and was their good friend at one point. So we know he can be rational, but is he rational now? Or is he some weird hybrid of crazy like a fox and rational? What would you care to go and make and do a Carnac the Magnificent analysis of where his brain is?
Oh. Well, oh, you're asking such easy questions, John.
I mean, bag of cat or crazy like a fox.
Well, it's. I think the first thing you have to say is A, he's not stupid. The second thing you have to say is he has more freedom of action than we do because he's not limited by things like morals or scruples. I am absolutely certain that however much damage a strike would do to Syria, he would come out of it saying, they didn't put no hardly scratched. I can survive this just fine. I mean, he could be bleeding and one arm could be gone off, and he's going to look like he's going to be talking like the Black Knight. The fact that it isn't true isn't going to limit him in the least. So what we're going to have to look for is his survival. As you said earlier, he's interested in regime survival. Anything that doesn't cripple the ability of his regime to function, he will probably ignore. And that doesn't make him irrational or crazy. It just means he's using a very different set of rules than we do. He's not interested in the welfare of his people, and maybe not even in the welfare of his particular Alawite supporters, as long as he personally stays in power. But that's
me. And this brings in the other half of the asymmetrical response options. He isn't doing this alone. He has significant support from both Russia, which has had skin in this game going back to the 1950s and the rise of the original Baath movement with his father. At the same time, you have Iran and Hezbollah on his side as well.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about those groups and how they affect the equation.
Well, it's like a whole other layer on this this issue. The fact that Russia is backing Syria because of their long relationship and because Syria is one of their last foreign allies, as well as a paying customer. How they're probably paying with Iranian money. But Syria represents, for Iran even more so, what's the right word, a gate into the region and a base for Hezbollah. And if Assad's regime falls, then Russia and Iran both take a major political and foreign policy hit. So they're gonna back these guys, they're gonna back Assad up until the very last minute, and they won't cut and run until it's clear that Assad can't come back in any way. Their support is what's been bolstering Assad from the get-go. If he was a tin-pot dictator like Papa Doc Duvalier or Ceausescu in Romania, who had no friends, they had managed to alienate everybody and anybody, so as soon as the rebels started knocking on the door, they were more than willing to trade their personal survival for their regime, and they just left. As long as Syria and Assad, as long as Assad has the Russians and the Iranians giving him that 110% support, he thinks he can survive. If we could convince Russia that it was not in their interest to support Syria, he might cave. I don't think we could convince Russia, and I certainly don't think we could convince Iran.
Well, our relations with both those countries are at best strained right now, and in one case, almost non-existent. Let's try and wrap this up a little bit, because let's face it, we are talking about just a massive, massive problem, and God bless the poor guys over at the J3 shop at the Pentagon, who minute by minute, hour by hour, are fine-tuning this and trying to put a credible response out on the board for everybody. What kind of things can we conclude that we're going to see, and maybe most importantly, as we were talking a few minutes before the show, what's the end state here? How does it, when it's all over, what does this situation look like a week, a month, a year later? And I'm going to let you go and throw this against the wall and see if anything sticks.
Well, it's, everybody likes to talk. You get the policy wonks started, and they say, well, you have to define the end state, and you can't know where you're going until you know which direction to head. And, yes, that's true, but we can't control. I mean, that implies more control than we actually have over the situation. What we have is an ability to get into the game, which we are not right now, and possibly build some sort of relations with the Free Syrian Army, the moderate Syrians, who are probably not all that thrilled about working with Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is the opportunistic guy who shows up and says, hey, I can help you, and we'll talk about later what the price is. We want stability in the region. We would like a government that doesn't spend its time messing with Lebanon, with Israel, with everybody. My personal opinion is when we invaded the wrong country in 2003. If we had gone after Syria instead of Iraq, I think the world would be a better place. But that's neither here nor there. What we have to do is, if possible, convince Assad not to use any more chemical weapons. If at all possible, convince him that he's not going to win the war and he should leave voluntarily. And maybe by virtue of crippling his air force and possibly parts of his military, we might make it easier for the rebels to win. There are no good options in this conflict, and we just have to pick the least bad option and drive on. There's going to be a downside to anything we do. We just have to recognize that there is no perfect choice.
And pick, hopefully, the least bad option.
Yes, I mean, when I hear people saying, well, this is, you know, if we support the rebels, then we're supporting Al-Qaeda. No, we're supporting the rebels, and by the way, Al-Qaeda is allied with the rebels. I mean, we worked with the Russians in World War II, even though we couldn't stand, you know, the Stalin's communist state, because we had a common enemy. I wouldn't go so far as to say Bashar Assad is a common enemy with Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is there because the opportunity presents itself. We're there because we want to see the bloodshed stop, especially the mindless, nameless bloodshed of chemical weapons.
And that may be the most profound thing that got said here today, because chemical weapons are a different class of weapons. They kill more, they kill faster, and the circumstance, and, you know, and let's face it, dead may be dead, whether it's a machine gun bullet or a nuclear blast, but it's the nature and the numbers of what WMDs do that makes them so horrific to individuals.
Yes, and I hate to say it, but this was a relatively small-scale attack. I mean, the casualty count was very high because they attacked an urban neighborhood without warning. There are lots of urban neighborhoods like that, and if the Assad wanted to really drive home the point, he could cause an even more devastating casualty count somewhere else in his non-Alawite portion of Syria. These people are, you know, innocents will always die in war. They don't have to die this way, in my opinion, if we can at all stop it.
And as you say, that may very well be the bottom line here, because this is a civil war, and it's not – civil wars are the ugly kind. And if you don't believe that, look at our own, because we lost more Americans in our civil war than in all the wars since then.
We were very lucky in our civil war in that I believe both sides believed in the old – line about trial by combat, and when the issue was decided in the Union's favor, a lot of Southerners simply accepted it and got back to whatever they were doing and stopped fighting. That's not always the case in a civil war. It may not be the case in this one. I mean, there will be continued instability, but I have to believe that somebody other than Bashar Assad in charge and other than Al-Qaeda in charge might possibly provide a Syria that is less troublesome to the region. In any case, the war is not a good thing. A civil war can spread. A civil war can cause unintended consequences that nobody can possibly anticipate. The quicker it's stopped and the less violence there is while it's going on, the better.
Because it's not like the rest of the region isn't sitting there ready to explode like a bottle of nitroglycerin on the back of a rickety truck.
Yes. We have, again, because Assad can cause so much pain and discontent in other directions, the choice, it isn't about regime change, and I hate that term. It's about either getting him out of there, and that is the announced position of the United States, has been for a couple of years, I guess. So getting him out of there with as little bloodshed as possible, or helping the rebels win, again, with as little bloodshed as possible. And there's just nothing else to do.
And with that, we are done with Syria for today, but there's still the question that everybody wants to know: what are you doing, and what's next coming out of Larry Bond, Inc.?
Oh, Larry Bond, Inc. No, I have not incorporated. I couldn't send the paperwork. We've got a lot of games coming up. We've got a new book, which I cannot announce the title of, and it's not a Jerry Mitchell book. It's a new book, and I hope people like it, because if they like it, then it might become a series. So, yeah, there's another novel in the works. And look for some interesting
This is with your regular publisher, Tor Books?
This is with Tor Books, and Chris Carlson's my co-author again. And I was working on Chapter 21 right before I called you on the phone. Out of 24, so woo-hoo. We're getting close. I'm on Facebook. I encourage people to check out my site, and I always post covers and other things going on and try and keep people updated on the progress of different projects. It takes me a year to write one of these things, and unfortunately people read them more quickly than that. So it's not always easy to keep up with demand, but I do my best.
And what do you have coming out in the Admiralty trilogy of naval war games that you support?
Okay, if you don't get the naval sit rep and you're interested in that kind of stuff, there's the magazine newsletter, I should say. It's not a magazine, although it's 32 pages with a color cover, and it talks about naval technology and history. And this is a very interesting issue coming up in October, because we talk about the littoral combat ship, which is not my favorite platform. But that's an ongoing thing. We've got Shattered Armada, which is going to be a very nice supplement on the Spanish Civil War that we're working on. That's going to be out this spring. We're also supporting a supplement we did a long time ago called Rising Sun, which is the first half of World War II in the Pacific. And somebody with more patience than I can possibly imagine has produced a booklet of 350 ship forms for all the ships that took part in all the surface battles in the first part of the Pacific War. And we're going to be publishing that electronically as a PDF for people to look at and use for their games.
And will there ever
Beyond
be
that,
Computer Harpoon next version?
We are working on that. We are in negotiations with one company, and if those don't pan out, there's at least one other one that's expressed interest. It's a lot like Hollywood. It's putting all the right pieces together, and frankly, it's a lot like Hollywood in terms of the money involved these days in producing a major game. It gets expensive. It's not two guys in a garage anymore. I'll say that. So we're trying very hard to make it happen. There's been a lot of demand, a lot of interest. Matrix has the current version, which is available for download. In fact, they have several versions available for download. But we really want to come up with a new one, which just ramps up the interface and updates the weapon systems and just blows the socks off of everything that's been done before.
Very good. Larry, I want to thank you for coming again on the show. It's always a pleasure to talk to you and the people around you. Good luck on everything you're doing, and come back and talk to us again when it suits you.
Anytime, John. I'm it's been a lot of fun.
Thank you very much, and have a great afternoon. Go back to Chapter 21.
Yes, sir. Right away. Bye.
Take care. And with that, we're getting ready to close out this edition of Military Monday. But before we go, I'd like to just say we are a couple of days away from going and commemorating the 12th anniversary of one of the darkest days in American history. I'm talking about September 11th. This is a day that's come to mean some very, very important things to America, not just for what happened in 2001, but what happened last year as well. So when you go through your day on Wednesday, take a little time. Think about the almost 3,000 who perished back in 2001. And let's not forget the four, including Ambassador Chris Stevens, who died a year ago. Days like this are meant to be remembered and never forgotten. And with that, I'm going to close out this edition of Military Monday. Say have a great week ahead. Please take care, and we'll see you next Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for Military Monday. Thank you very much.